Okay, so when I say particle in a box, you probably have in mind a box like this, and the particle is doing something inside that box. So what I'm going to do is, first of all, reduce the number of dimensions down to 1. Okay, so we're going to imagine that it's really like this. We have like a wire here, and we have a bead. There's a bead on the wire. Okay, and in the non-quantum world, what you can do is give that bead a kick, and it will bounce back and forth. And it's frictionless and all that stuff. Okay, so we're just imagining a particle in a one-dimensional box. So it's confined to the x-axis between two limits. So by particle in a box, I mean the particle is confined between x equals 0 and x equals L. There's a barrier here that it reflects off of. And we'll assume that the particle here has some mass m. Okay, what it's doing classically, when I say classical, I mean non-quantum. I mean just ordinary kind of physics, Newtonian physics. What it's doing classically, if I kick it like this, it just bounces back and forth. Quantum mechanically, what it's doing is something rather bizarre. Okay, and so I don't even know how to indicate that. So it's whatever. It's something. It's doing something. Okay, now the only thing, and we're going to try to figure out what that is. Now the only thing we're going to say about this is that we suppose that it has a definite amount of energy. Okay, so suppose energy, it has an energy E. Okay, so many joules of energy. So somehow we've given that particle some energy. Maybe we've flicked it with our finger like this. We've given it a certain amount of energy. And what we're going to try to do is use this de Broglie relationship to learn about what it's doing. Okay, so first of all, what kind of energy does it have? Just classically, kinetic. It's just kinetic, right? So it's just bouncing back and forth, just kinetic. So I can say E is 1/2 mv squared. What is that in terms of momentum? Right. So that's the same thing as p squared divided by 2m. If I replace v with v with p over m, I get this. And this is actually it turns out that in quantum mechanics, momentum is much more important than velocity. Nature doesn't care about velocity. Nature only seems to care about momentum. Okay. Okay, so let's see. So what does that tell us? If I solve for p, I have this relation of E is equal to p squared over 2m. I'm saying we have a definite energy, say 5 joules or something. How do I solve for p? What's p? Is everyone happy with that? Really? You guys are happy with that?
Plus or minus.
Uh-huh.
Well, is momentum is pronounced vectorially or?
Yeah, so we're thinking of this as px. Actually, in an abusive notation, I will be thinking of either the magnitude of p or px, okay, depending upon the context. I will be using the symbol p for. Okay, and you'll just see from the context what I mean here. So by p here, I mean really px, momentum in the x direction. It can be plus this number or minus that number. Okay. So, and that's very important. This is a very important lesson. And it turns out that in physics, like what do you do in physics? Basically, you look at the world, you try to make some sense of it, and then you convert your sense of that into mathematical language. And then you play with the math, and you find solutions. You basically try all of the, like in this case, there are two solutions. And both of those solutions are very, very important. The point is that whenever you've got some mathematical expression, or you're trying to solve some equation or something, always look at the most general solution. A good example of that is Dirac, when he was when he combined the ideas of special relativity with quantum. There was a similar sort of a plus-minus sign, okay, and that was closely related to the idea of antimatter. Okay, so if he had just ignored the minus sign, then it would just be sort of matter, but adding that minus sign is related to antimatter. Okay, or the fact there's two signs is related to anything. Okay, so let's see. So here we have a particle. Its momentum is either plus this or minus this. When it's plus, it means that it's moving to the right. When it's minus, it's moving to the left. Okay, so right, left. All right. So what is the wavelength, corresponding wavelength? So now we're saying, okay, I know what P is. In this relationship, P means the magnitude of the momentum. Okay, so because lambda wavelength is always positive. So I'm trying to use this relationship to learn something about these particles, particle behavior. So what is the corresponding wavelength? It's h divided by the magnitude of the momentum, which is just h over root 2me. It's a positive number. Okay? So what we've done is we've started by saying the only thing I'm going to assume is that the particle has some mass m and that it has some energy e. And then by applying and doing whatever some reasoning over here, we've ended up with the statement that associated with that particle whose energy is e, there is some kind of a wave whose wavelength is h divided by the square root of 2me. If I give you e, you know what the momentum is. Okay? So that's the first thing. So now let's look at those waves. Let's try to imagine the presence of waves in that box. Because somehow that de Broglie relationship is suggesting associated with that particle is some kind of wave. If we put a wave in a box, you know, some interesting things happen. Okay, so let's look at these. First of all, suppose that the momentum is plus square root of 2me. That means that the particle is moving to the right. And so we would also expect that whatever wave is associated with that wavelength, lambda, is also moving to the right. That would be a reasonable thing to imagine. Okay, so we've got a wave that's moving to the right, like this. But this particle is bound to the box. Okay, when the particle hits x equals l there, it bounces off. What happens when a wave hits a boundary like that? It reverses and it reflects. It reflects back like this. We have this reflected wave coming back. And when we add up those two waves, what do we get? We get interference, yeah. Standing waves, yeah, all that stuff, constructive, destructive interference, and so on. Yes. So the point is, if we have a particle moving to the right, then that somehow corresponds to a wave moving to the right. If we have a wave moving to the right, we necessarily have a wave moving to the left, like this. And there's going to be some interference between those two waves. Okay, so there's necessarily a reflected wave. Okay, now I want you to notice that if you've got a particle, the reflection of the particle is no problem, right? So here the particle is localized, right? It just buzzes along like this and then it bounces off, right? Whereas the wave, all we're told is that we have a wave of wavelength lambda. We're not told how long the wave is, like it's a wave train. We're not told how long it is. Okay? So it's not like it's just a tiny bit of a wave like that. Okay, all we're told is it has a wavelength lambda. One wavelength lambda. And so it's actually a continuous wave train like this associated with that particle. Okay, and so when it bounces off, we get another continuous wave train like that. And so this interference pattern is over a distributed size here. And it's not just at the particle. Okay. Just a side point here. Okay, what if P is minus root 2me? Classically or non-quantum mechanically, that corresponds to a particle moving to the left. And so somehow there's the suggestion that we have a wave moving to the left. When it reflects off of this barrier, we're going to get a wave moving to the right, and we're going to get some kind of interference pattern. So basically, we are forced into a superposition of waves. Okay? So because we've got a barrier here, if we've got a right moving wave, we necessarily have a left moving one. If we have a barrier here, if we have a left moving one, we necessarily have a right moving one. Okay, so we're forced to have two waves that are present simultaneously, a superposition of right and left. Okay, so that's really important. Now let's actually look at an applet here. So Sean, I wonder if you could turn on the projector again, bring down the screen. Thank you. Okay, so this is a really cool applet. Let's have a look at it. So this is an applet which shows the reflection of a wave. Oops. Okay. Okay. All right. So it should come on. No, it's not on. Let's try that. Okay, well, there's something. But then that disappeared. Okay. Excellent. All right. So here we see a wave, which is, where's our little pointer here? So here we see a wave which is traveling to the right. Okay, so, and it's going to encounter a barrier here, and it's going to reflect from that barrier. Okay, so this wave is a continuous wave train with a certain wavelength. The wavelength is the distance from between these two troughs here, or between those two crests. Okay, and when it encounters the barrier, there's a reflection. Okay, so this is the reflected wave in blue, which is coming back. Okay, so we have the red wave is moving to the right, the blue wave is the reflected wave moving to the left, and then there's a black wave here, which shows the sum of the two. Okay, they interfere with each other, and crests add to crests, and troughs add to troughs, crests and troughs cancel each other out, and so on and so forth. Okay, and so the black indicates the shows the superposition or the combination of the left and the right moving wave. Okay, so what you'll notice is what we end up with is an interesting pattern of waves. So we still got the right moving and the left moving, but their sum is something which is not moving at all. It's neither moving to the right nor the left. Like, look at this peak here. As it just, the peak goes up and down, okay, but the location of the peak never changes. It always remains right there. Okay, so that's called an antinode. And similarly, there are places where the superposition of those two waves is always zero, okay, right there. So if you look at that point over there, at, say, this instant of time now, there's a plus and a minus. There's a crest and a trough that add up. Or now, there's a trough and a crest that add up to make that point permanently zero. So there's zero amplitude of vibration at the nodes, labeled N here. And there's maximum amplitude of vibration at the antinodes labeled A here. Okay? And the important thing is that individually there's a right moving wave which is red and a left moving wave which is blue, but the sum of the two is not moving, and that's called a standing wave. Okay? So that's the kind of thing that we would expect to be happening inside this box. Okay? It will be a standing wave of wavelength lambda, and the wavelength will be the distance between, say, that node and that node there. That's one full wavelength. You can see there's a sine wave or a negative sine wave. There's a sine wave there. So one complete wavelength is the distance from one node to two nodes over, okay, or the second node over. OK, so excellent. Is that clear? Cool applet, eh? I love that applet. OK. So at the end of the day, what we find is that, so we started with a particle with some energy that tells us the momentum is plus or minus blah blah, and associated with that, according to the de Broglie relationship, is some kind of a wave. if we have right moving in a wave, there must be left moving, and so on and so forth, because the particle is bound. That's very important. Okay, so what we end up with is something like this. Okay, if we had, suppose the particle were not bound, suppose it were just, suppose we had just this situation. Suppose we had a right moving wave that's infinitely long, and a left moving wave that's infinitely long wave trains, and we add those guys together. So when, so it's like this, and we add them together, what we're going to get is a standing wave. We're going to get a, which looks basically like this. And it's infinitely long in both directions. Okay, and there will be places. So the way this standing wave goes, the way it works is, at this end, this is a snapshot at one instant of time. The wave pattern looks like this. As time goes on, this crest here will move down, and this trough here will move up. There will be an instant of time where it's flat, and then this guy will reverse. That crest will be a trough, and that trough will become a crest. Okay? And so this is the kind of picture that you draw for it. That's what a standing wave looks like. So it oscillates like this, and these points are fixed. Okay? And now there's a very important point here, and that is when we have a wave confined to a box, the boundaries of the box need to be at these nodes. For example, we could put the boundaries of the box here and here. Okay? Or we could put the boundaries of the box, say, left boundary here, left right boundary here, or left boundary here, right boundary here. We couldn't, for example, put left boundary here and right boundary here. Okay? Because at the boundary, the waves, the way the waves reflect, they reflect such that their amplitude is zero. If you tried to do this, you would force that wave to zero amplitude, and it couldn't fit. It doesn't fit inside the box. Okay? And so the allowed sizes of box, for a given wavelength, the allowed sizes of box are this big, or this big, or this big, and so on and so forth. Or we'll actually turn that around and we'll say we have a box of fixed size, and we will look at the allowed standing waves inside that box. Let me actually run another applet here. So Sean, I don't know if we can turn this thing on so quickly again. I can find that other one. Actually, let's just leave that out. Okay. So let me just say a couple more words, and then we will stop. Okay. So basically, we look at a standing wave pattern like this of a given wavelength, and say the box can be this big, this big, or this big. Or we say we have a thick box of fixed size, and we can put certain standing waves inside that box. So what are the allowed standing waves? Let's draw a picture of those guys. Okay, so between 0 and L, what is the smallest box that we could have? Box goes from here to where? The next one over here. Okay, so what we have is a standing wave like this, which oscillates up and down. Okay, so it would look like this. Okay, so that's what the pattern looks like. And this is, let's just call it psi. It's a function of x, obviously. Okay. We call that psi 0. And so this is the amplitude of the wave, okay? And we know that associated with that amplitude of the wave is a particle probability. So suppose that the particle is in some kind of a state where its wavelength is such that, you know, half of a wavelength fits inside the box, because of course this is a full wavelength, it's 2L. So we have a wave such that half of the wavelength fits inside the box. We have this standing wave bouncing back and forth. And what we know is that the probability, the particle probability, is related to the square of, right? So when we're talking about waves coming into this double slit apparatus to get this pattern here, is the square of the amplitude. And we identified the square of the amplitude, which is the intensity of the wave, with the particle probability pattern. Okay, so if we square this, we get a curve which looks something like this. Okay? And let's look at another one. Okay, so same size of box between 0 and L. But now we can fit a standing wave in there with more lumps. How many lumps? 2 lumps. Okay, so a standing wave which looks like this. Okay, so it's got a node there and there, has to have at the ends of the box, but and also a node right in the center. Okay, so the standing wave is doing this sort of thing. If we square that amplitude, what do we get? What does it look like here? 2 positive peaks. Okay, so when I square a positive, I get a positive. When I square a negative, I get also a positive. So I got 2 peaks like that. Okay? And what is this supposed to mean? Well, what this means is if the particle is in this kind of state here, then if we were to look in the box, we would find that maybe the particle is over there. Or if we would look at a different time, maybe we'd find it over there, and so on. There's a high probability we would find the particle, if we looked inside the box, somewhere in this region, where this pattern, which we'll call P0, is large. And there's low probability that we would find it near the end of the box. This pattern over here, we'll call this one psi 1 here. Okay, so that's the wave amplitude. When we square that amplitude to get the probability, we'll call that probability pattern P1. Okay, so a probability pattern like this means that if we look inside the box, and the particle could be anywhere when we look inside the box, but it's most likely to be found either around here, where the probability pattern is peaked, or around here. It's not likely to be found here or near the ends of the box. Okay, so that's what we've learned so far. And finally, we've also learned about the energy. The energy associated with a particle in this weird state of motion, whatever it is E0 is P squared over 2m. We know that P is h over lambda. So if I plug P equal h over lambda into here, what I get is h squared over 2m lambda squared. What is the wavelength here in terms of L? Right, so the wavelength lambda is 2L here. If I plug for lambda, if I plug in 2L squared, it gives me 4L squared times 2 is 8. Okay, so what I get is h squared over 8ml squared. Yeah.
The issue in electrons, though?
Yeah.
So the one part of the electron goes to one slit, how does the wave go to the other slit if the particle which is making the wave has gone to one slit?
The particle is making the wave. So what we're doing is we're clearly separating between particle and wave here. So what we're imagining is we're saying, okay, here is our double slit apparatus here. We know that it leaves as a particle here, because the source is very, very tiny. And definitely it's a localized clump of something coming out. And it hits a detector here. That detector is small in size as well. So what we're detecting is lumps of energy here. Okay, so we know it's a particle here, and we know it's a particle here. What it's doing in between, we don't know. And what we're doing is we're saying we're replacing our knowledge of what it's doing in between with, we're settling for just the ability to calculate the probabilities of it hitting, you know, this way or that way, or like this location or that location on the screen. So it's not that the particle is creating the wave or anything like that. The wave, in this interpretation of quantum mechanics, there are different interpretations which we'll talk a little bit about. In this interpretation of quantum mechanics, the wave is just an abstract mathematical device used to calculate the probability of a particle hitting at this location or that location. So we just take this picture, replace it entirely with one where waves go through, look at the intensity pattern of the waves, and that matches the probability pattern of the particles. Okay, but it's particles here and particles there. Waves enter only in trying to understand the probability pattern. Okay, And E1 here, what is the wavelength here in terms of L?
L.
So lambda is just L. So we would use this same formula here, and we would get h squared over 2m L squared. How does E1 relate to E0? How big is E1 compared to E0? How much bigger?
Four times.
So E1 is 4 times E0. Okay. So let me just make a note of that here. So if you were to look at various different possible states there, what you will find is the particle that's in that box, it only has certain allowed states. Okay, so that's zero energy. What we found is the first allowed energy, E0, is some non-zero value there. Okay? And the second allowed energy is up here, is 4 times E0. So E1 is 4 times E0. And if you look at the next one, you'll find the next one is at 9 times E0, and so on. Okay, so the point is that that the energy here, a particle inside a confined to a box, particle of mass m confined to a box of size L, there's m and L, cannot just have any old energy. Yeah, cannot give it like just a small amount of energy and then increase its energy arbitrarily. Okay, it can have only certain discrete allowed values of energy, which depend upon m and l this way. There's Planck's constant involved, h squared over 8m l squared. That's the lowest energy. The next energy is this guy over here. The next energy is this guy over here. The particle cannot have this amount of energy, for example. Okay? So if I want it to go from here to here, I have to give it exactly this amount of energy. If I try to give that particle any energy that's different from this difference here, it just wouldn't accept the energy. If I tried to give the particle this much energy here, it simply wouldn't accept it. It can only accept this amount of energy, and then it will jump to this amount, having this amount of energy. Or it can accept this amount of energy, the difference here, and then it will jump to this. But if I tried to give it this much energy by like flicking it with my finger, it wouldn't accept the energy. Okay? So it has only these discrete allowed values of energy like this. So just to summarize here, so bound, as soon as you have a bound particle, that means bound, say, to a box. Okay, that tells you that according to this de Broglie relationship, a bound particle means a bound wave because lambda is h over p. Particle momentum p, there's an associated wavelength. So now it becomes a bound wave. As soon as you have a wave that's bound to some region, there are reflections back and forth, and there are standing waves. So there are allowed standing waves. Okay, so allowed standing waves means waves of only certain wavelengths, which means, using the de Broglie relation again, if you are only allowed certain wavelengths, that means you are only allowed certain only certain allowed momentum. Which tells us certain allowed energy, because energy is just p squared over 2m. Okay, so the point here is that it's actually superposition. It's these allowed, we only have certain allowed standing waves. It's that superposition thing which is the real mystery, not sort of quantization. Okay, so I guess what I, and the other thing here to say just before we quit here is that this E0, this is called zero point energy. And that zero point energy is not zero. Okay, so you might think if I have a particle in a box here, like a bead on a wire here, I can give that bead just zero energy. It can have zero energy, it can just be sitting there. Well, it turns out in the real world, in the quantum world, that's not true. It has always some small amount of energy, some minimum energy that's not zero, called the zero point energy. And that zero point energy is of huge significance to the nature of our universe. It explains why atoms can exist. It explains why this table exists. And we'll talk about that. Okay, so it's very, very important.